Montreal is a common destination for Inuit people of the Northern Territories who decide to leave their communities to escape poor housing conditions and issues related to homelessness. But often these individuals renew with the social problems of the North here in Montreal. Montreal has a large homeless population in which Inuit people are overrepresented. The lack of knowledge about Inuit people, their culture, and histories by the general Canadian public contributes to misconceptions, stereotypes, and racisms against Inuit people, especially towards those who are struggling with homelessness on the streets of Montreal. Many Canadians ask themselves, why can't those Inuit people figure out their housing situation? Why are there so many homeless Inuit people on the streets? Why can't they just adapt to modern Western ways of living? It's their problem. They should try and, like, figure it out. And, like, whose responsibility is it anyway? I'm trying to cause a big sensation. Just talking about my generation. All right. Maybe they don't quite exactly say it like that, but there certainly are stereotypes and misconceptions towards Inuit people going on every day in our community, which perpetuate racisms. Whose responsibility is it to deal with housing? That's a pretty good question. Whose responsibility is it to deal with the current ongoing housing crisis anyway? Very few Canadians know or care to know about the roots of Inuit homelessness, which are deeply embedded in the colonial history of the Canadian state's interference with Inuit affairs and their way of life in Canada's north, that has forever changed the traditional lifestyles of Inuit people and has had devastating effects on their well-being. Inuit homelessness is something that most Montrealers who walk the downtown streets or use the public transit system are quite likely to encounter frequently, especially throughout the winter months. However, very few Montrealers have been educated about Inuit histories or know about the historical context of Inuit homelessness. And therein lies the intention of this piece. We will try to reconstruct or deconstruct or simply try to raise your awareness about the post-World War I era in Canada's north and highlight some of the state interferences that took place, such as the slaughter of Inuit sled dogs by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and the forced relocation of many Inuit communities to permanent year-round settlement villages. We will look at the impacts that this period of Canadian history and relations between the Canadian state and Inuit people has had on the current Inuit housing conditions. The availability and sustainability of housing has been an issue for Inuit since the 1950s and 1960s, when families began living year-round in places that make up today's communities of Inuit Nunangat. During the Cold War, the U.S. military installed radar stations in several Arctic locations. Some employment and housing opportunities for Inuit came with the establishment of the Canada-U.S. Distant Early Warning Line. In 1956, federal policy for housing in Inuit Nunangat began in 1959 as the Department of Indian Affairs and Northern Development began its first housing program for Eskimos. Eskimo families with the financial capability were encouraged to buy houses. Who were indigent were provided welfare housing. Houses were bought by the department and resold to the Eskimos. However, as the resale program progressed, many problems became evident. The two most important being the cost of the houses themselves and the high cost of heating them during the winter months. Consequently, some buyers fell behind their payments or made none at all. The small size of the units also proved to be unsatisfactory, for this meant the perpetuation of many of the health and overcrowding problems that the houses were intended to alleviate. Since that time, housing, community infrastructure, and services have continued to lag behind the needs of populations. Inuit have been living in overcrowded conditions for decades despite further housing efforts, such as the, quote, Eskimo Loan program of the 1960s that promoted home ownership through a rent-to-own plan. These houses were made of plywood with one or two rooms and are still known as matchboxes. The efforts failed due to a high utility cost. The program was redesignated to become the, quote, Eskimo Rental Housing Program, with the goal of establishing housing for all Inuit by the 1970s. High rates of respiratory and digestive diseases have been associated with poor housing conditions and were reported to have decreased after the redesigning program was established in 1966. Which, according to today's statistics, is untrue. All right, it's time to go back in time to before World War II. We're going to explore an overview of the change in Inuit housing from pre- and post-colonial state interference. Since World War II, the Canadian government has initiated profound social, economic, and cultural changes in the North that have had far-reaching, negative, and lingering influence on the lives of Inuit communities. The vast majority of these decisions were made without consulting Inuit communities, and the consequences are still felt today. There is much healing and forgiveness that needs to take place between Inuit communities whose traditional lifestyles have deteriorated as a result of colonial state interference. There is much healing and forgiveness among Inuit communities who have suffered from historic wrongs, and there's a need to repair relations between Inuit and the Canadian colonial state. Since World War II, there has been a vast change in Inuit housing and traditional lifestyle since the colonial state forced permanent relocation of Inuit communities from nomadic small kinship groups to year-round permanent settlements. Before 1950, most Inuit families lived on the land in tightly knit kinship groups, ranging from 5 to 30 people, where each person was valued for their contribution to the group's well-being and success. They moved between Inuit communities by dog team or boat, depending on the season, in pursuit of the wildlife that supplied most of their food, clothing, and shelter. This deep connection to the land sustained a rich culture and language. But after 1950, the Canadian government created 13 settlements in the Baffin region and many, many, many other permanent settlements across Canada's north. This was reflective of Ottawa's plan to educate Inuit children and provide medical treatment and distribute family allowances, welfare, and old age pensions. Some Inuit did move to these settlements voluntarily for employment, as their traditional lifestyle was being negatively affected by state interference. Others willingly moved to these settlements for free healthcare and low rent housing. Others moved to avoid separation from children attending residential school or to join family members who had already relocated. Still others moved because they felt coerced and forced to relocate by government authorities. The decision to give up a traditional way of life was almost never an easy one, and once made, it proved to be irreversible. Inuit made enormous personal and cultural sacrifices by moving into permanent settlements. Whether or not they moved voluntarily, many Inuit found that promises of a better life were not kept and felt their lives were made worse, not better, by the move. Settlement life imposed a new form of poverty, and the lack of access to the land hindered the ability to obtain the country food that nourished their bodies and souls, since their people had been living on the land from time immemorial. As a result, Inuit often despaired as they their family members, and neighbors struggled to adjust to circumstances beyond their control. And in there lies an assimilation project carried out by the Canadian state. From forced or voluntary settlement life to substance abuse. Settlement life made Inuit dependent on government, producing imbalanced power relations between the two. All aspects of Inuit daily life and relationships changed in the settlements. For example, some elders felt useless, and many husbands and sons could not reconcile their new circumstances with their desire to provide for their families, since their hunting traditions had been deteriorated. Traditional marriage practices and adoptions were challenged by state or government officials. Settlements seem crowded because many neighbors were also strangers, a completely new situation for Inuit who are used to a tightly knit kinship-based community. Inuit who lacked snowmobiles to access the land felt that life in the settlements was a form of imprisonment because they were no longer using their traditional methods of transportation, be it boat traveling or sled dog traveling. Settlement life also brought many Inuit into regular contact with alcohol for the first time, which along with gambling and drugs provided an unhealthy distraction. Inuit lived in settlements without the social controls that existed in tightly knit Inuit communities, or without knowledge of Western cultural practices that distinguished between drinking for inebriation, drinking as part of enjoyment of food, and drinking to alter social experiences. And harsh, painful social realities and social changes. It is my personal opinion that the introduction of alcohol was a systemic way to encourage the deterioration of traditional Inuit lifestyle by the colonial state officials. By the 1970s, many families were experiencing the devastating consequences of substance abuse, including alcoholism, addiction, physical and sexual abuse, the neglect of children, poverty, and untimely death. Or suicide. Despite easily controlled access points, insufficient efforts were made to control entry of alcohol or drugs. Yet, Inuit were given little to no support to deal with the negative effects of either. Hunting has always been a defining element of Inuit culture. Inuit apply a deep understanding of their environmental laws, customs, and practices that ensure the wise use of the game resources. In the 1950s, the government stepped up enforcement laws based on southern conservation priorities rather than northern realities, and without the best interest of Inuit traditional lifestyles at heart. The Canadian Wildlife Service development laws that strictly defined the types, the numbers, and times of year that animal could be hunted without the benefit of Inuit knowledge or reliable information about Arctic game populations. Under such prohibitions, Inuit often had to choose whether to starve or hunt illegally and hide their catches from authorities to avoid fines and incarceration. All right. Things are looking pretty grim. But let's go further. Let's continue to deconstruct and shine light on another historical event of colonial interference in the lives of Inuit communities that has led to and had direct impacts on the ongoing housing crisis that we now see today and Inuit homelessness that we now see today. The care and management of a sled dog team was an integral part of Inuit culture and hunting traditions. Inuit have successfully managed sled dog teams for countless generations. Settlement life disrupted Inuit culture and threatened the lives of sled dogs. Between 1957 and 1975, the number of sled dogs in Inuit communities declined dramatically. They died from disease, were shot by hunters moving into settlements who thought sled dogs were not allowed or no longer useful, abandoned by owners working in settlements who didn't have time to hunt or care for their dogs now that they were adapting to a Western model of living. Some dogs were abandoned when Inuit were suddenly sent south for medical treatments for things such as tuberculosis, or were gradually replaced by snowmobiles. Hundreds of sled dogs were shot by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and other colonial authorities in settlements from the mid-1950s onward because the colonial authorities were afraid of loose dogs and feared they could spread disease. At the same time, dogs belonged to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. At the same time, dogs belonging to the RCMP, Inuit Special Constables, or Hudson Bay Company employees were often considered off-limits and not shot. These special exemptions created animosity between Inuit whose dogs were shot and those whose dogs were always spared. Both hunters and their families suffered terribly as a result of the loss of their sled dogs. There were not enough jobs in the settlements, and families became dependent on inadequate social assistance, payments, and welfare, and expensive, nutritionally deficient store-bought food, as their traditional hunting practices had deteriorated due to forced resettlement of their communities and a forced assimilation to a Western model of living. Many Inuit communities blame many of the killings on the ignorance of colonial officials who did not know how to care for and handle their sled dogs. Many Inuit also have expressed frustration and remorse. Frustration that they could not understand why so many sled dogs were shot when most did not pose a real threat at all. And remorse that they themselves did not stop the killings. This has been an overall very traumatic historical event for Inuit communities at large, and the loss of sled dogs and sled dog teams caused traditional Inuit modes of transportation and hunting practices to suffer severely. All right, next historical event. We mustn't forget the forced relocation of Inuit to southern hospitals to treat tuberculosis. Medical strategies intended to improve Inuit health by removing patients to southern hospitals succeeded in the primary goal, but inflicted other lasting trauma and damage. After 1950, with increased state interference in the affairs of Inuit communities, medical personnel on the new medical patrol ship CGS C.D. Howe screened Inuit for tuberculosis and other infectious diseases, removing the sick and infected without notice for indefinite periods in southern hospitals. The ship's helicopters sometimes tracked down Inuit who refused to be tested. Those sent south to hospitals for treatment endured weeks on board the ship and months or years in treatment away from their families. They experienced a profound sense of culture shock and dislocation both down south and upon their return. Children were essentially orphaned at southern tuberculosis facilities and disciplined in ways they would never have experienced at home, spanked, hit, force-fed, or tied down to their beds for hours on end. Officials also lost or mixed up records, failing to return both children and adults to their Inuit communities or districts. Other children were never returned, or returned years later upon discovery that they had been kept by well-meaning staff. Adults who returned from treatment were often unable to return to their former lives and ended up dependent on government relief. Allow us to deconstruct some of the housing realities for Inuit in Canada. National statistics tell the story. Half of Inuit live in overcrowded conditions, and 38.7% of them are considered in core need, meaning they do not live in and cannot access acceptable housing. Inuit of Nunavut are locked in a housing crisis that is worsening daily as the population booms and existing housing stock ages. In Nunavut, one half or 49% of the occupied dwellings were below housing standards, meaning they were either crowded or in need of major repairs or a combination of both. About one quarter or 23% of occupied dwellings require major repairs for items such as defective plumbing or defective electrical wiring, a leaking oil or sewage tank, or a broken hot water boiler. Approximately one third of occupied dwellings were classified as crowded based on the lack of enough bedrooms. Understanding the current housing crisis for Inuit in Canada is not an easy task. It reaches into every area of life and touches each individual. It requires an appreciation of the history of housing, the demographic profile of the population, and the local economy. Efforts to solve the current crisis will depend on taking an integrated view of the issue, understanding it as an economic as well as a social, political, and public health challenge. At the same time, efforts began to provide Canadian state education to Inuit children. Children were taken from their families and small communities and sent to boarding schools in towns or cities. A sense of ownership and responsibility for the school buildings were not part of the boarding school experience. Moreover, the school curricula did not include cultural knowledge, and the time spent by children in residential schools was time away from learning life skills among family. Residential schooling has affected the health of residential school survivors and their children and their grandchildren. Between 1949 and 1963 and 1963, Inuit attended different types of residential schools, such as mission schools, hostels, residential, or boarding schools. By 1964, 75% of children from the age of 6 to 15 years old were enrolled in residential schools. Children were removed from their families and communities for all or most of the year, did not learn their languages, did not experience their culture, or understand their heritage. Problem-solving skills and self-sufficiency instilled by parents as cultural values in the family context were not passed on to the children in residential schools. Growing up with little control over one's life, together with the removal and isolation from the family context, led to a, quote, learned helplessness based on the perception that one cannot control events or future outcomes of one's actions. This was determined by the Aboriginal Healing Foundation in 2004. The legacy of previous trauma remains very present in many families, and that part of the challenge is to address the past, while at the same time imagining the future. Clearly, the consequences of residential school attendance and the follow-on intergenerational impact remain part of the housing context for Inuit. The 1970s launched comprehensive legal agreements between Inuit and the State of Canada. Inuit are not governed under the Indian Act and have signed modern treaties with the federal and provincial territorial governments. These modern treaties are protected under Section 35 of the Canadian Constitution of 1982. Housing corporations were created in the early 1970s and assumed responsibility for delivering housing. However, a housing crisis has persisted for decades in Nunavut and Nunavik, to a lesser degree in Nunatsiavut and the Inuvialuit settlement region of the Northern Territories. The issue intensified in the early 1990s when the Canadian government suspended new and decreased existing funding for social housing units. As a result, a limited number of dwellings have been built in the past two decades. To give you an idea of the magnitude of the problem and of costs in Nunavut, the estimated number of houses needed right now to meet demand is 4,000. The government of Nunavut estimates that the cost to build a standard, very modest housing unit is about $275,000. Add to that the operating costs, which include electricity costs of 40 cents to 80 cents per kilowatt hour, compared to 5.3 cents to 9.9 cents in Ontario, with a 20% increase now in the works. Costs of living and commodities are generally higher in the Inuit homelands than in other places in Canada, whether for doing business, delivering services or programming, or building houses. Nunavut Housing Corporation estimated in the early 1990s that construction costs in Nunavut average at $330 per square foot, compared to $104 per square foot in southern Canadian communities. The government of Nunavut has expressed that it cannot keep up with long-term housing pressures. The remoteness of the location brings economic, logistical, and fiscal challenges to those who finance, build, and maintain housing in the Inuit regions. There are several key factors contributing to the high cost of housing in the North, which include geographical remoteness, materials needed to build for climate conditions are costly, limited access to skilled labor and trades, limited building or construction season due to the weather and sea ice. Homes are expensive to heat and maintain. Overcrowding, long waiting lists for housing units, and the psychosocial consequences of these pressures on individuals and families have been and continue to be a characteristic of life in the Inuit regions. One of the issues that occurred when Inuit communities were forced to permanent settlements is that culturally appropriate housing was never made an option. Culturally appropriate Inuit housing refers to dwellings that suit the needs of Inuit family activities and behaviors and take into account the style of homemaking. In the 50s through to the 70s, the buildings used as residential housing did not reflect the social, economical, and ideological realities for Inuit. For example, there was nowhere to butcher seals in the living area. Store seal meat. Inuit families were forced to store meat in bathtubs, use their dining tables as workbenches, and repair snow machines indoors. Even the current dwellings in the Inuit region have been built with the Southern nuclear family-based concept of homemaking as the template, resulting in homes which remain culturally inappropriate for Inuit families. Homelessness is the natural outcome of the way we have organized our housing system and the way we allocate or fail to allocate income and support services when they are desperately needed. Now that you've had the opportunity to learn about Inuit housing realities and deconstruct the history of colonial state interference and intervention in Inuit housing traditions and traditional Inuit ways of life, I hope that this will allow you to better understand the complex history of colonial state interference and intervention that has taken place across the Inuit homelands, and how this is largely responsible for what we now call the ongoing Inuit housing crisis and the overrepresentation of Inuit people in the Montreal homeless population. When asked the question, whose responsibility is it to deal with the ongoing Inuit housing crisis, one should consider taking a decolonizing perspective on the issue of Inuit housing realities. It is the responsibility of both the neocolonial Canadian state, the federal and provincial Canadian governments, and of Inuit communities. It is the responsibility of all three levels of society to create the necessary changes, services, infrastructures, and provide the necessary funding to address the issue of Inuit housing realities. It is my strong hope that now, when you think about Inuit housing realities and Inuit homelessness, you will be able to better situate yourself in relation to the ongoing colonial past, present, and future, which is affecting the lives of Inuit communities every day and other First Nations communities across Turtle Island. For more information about the ongoing Inuit housing crisis, please visit the website of Makivik Corporation, a by and for Inuit organization that works closely with the issue of Inuit homelessness in Montreal. Makivik is spelled M-A-K-I-V-I-K, You can also learn more about realities surrounding homelessness across Canada by visiting ckut.ca/homeless. In closing, I will leave you with some insight from the Inuit caseworker from the Women's Daytime Shelter of Chez Doris in downtown Montreal. She shares her perspective about the housing situation in her homeland.
I'm from Kogloktok, Nunavut. There's what, maybe 1,500 people live there, I think. It's a small, small community. Most Western community in Nunavut. There's housing shortage there too. It has social issues, you know, with abuse and addictions and all that stuff. The conditions, there's maybe 20, maybe 30% that are so, you know, with mold and really old. The other maybe 70% is all, you know, they're all renovated. But there's a small amount where some are so with the mold and all that. That's a big thing too. That causes a lot of health problems too, to have to live in a home with that stuff. Because I have a cousin that she's in it right now. She's complained to housing, to the board. Yeah, we'll do something. Still nothing. And she's got her baby, he's two. What she did was she got the health inspector. The health inspector called the guys at housing. They came to her house with the health inspector, and the guys from housing were mad at her for calling the health inspector. But they still haven't done anything. She just has her baby and her son. It's a little three, but maybe the size of this right here.
This room?
Yeah.
Room is about eight feet by 10.
It's a three-bedroom house. It's a really, it's just like a little matchbox.
Yeah.
Kind of type house. And
but often the families have to share their homes.
Yeah, yeah. And exactly that's what she did. She comes from a family with a lot of sisters. So they were always there too at her place, like, you know. Mm-hmm. And overcrowding to it, that, you know, brings all that to. My brother, I had a brother, he lived in Vancouver and he lived on the streets, you know. He was gay, he wasn't accepted at home, and he had a hard time even just getting a house because of him being gay. Mm-hmm. He took off to Vancouver and he lived on the streets there and he died there. You know, it's just everywhere, always everywhere, homelessness, not even just up north, it's everywhere. Mm. Yeah. But you're starting to see it more and more now in the smaller, you know.
Communities.
Yeah. Not like before, but now you see it more.
Actually, it's funny you use the word seeing when we talk about hidden homelessness in the north. Because they don't have shelters like we do. Mm-hmm. They go hide in other people's house. So homelessness,
a cousin, you know, whatever.
For the authorities, it's not a problem. It's not in their hands. Mm-hmm. But for the people that receive them, it's a problem. Okay, mm-hmm. You receive these people because they're in trouble and they don't have shelters, and so that puts a burden on your family life, on your house and mm-hmm. home.
Mm-hmm. I know there's a few people like where I'm from. They live out at their cabins. Mm. Or they live in tent frames because they, you know, they're on a waiting list.
Yeah.
I was on a waiting list before and I waited 6 years before I got a house. I applied and it took me 6 years. And a couple before me, they waited 10 years. So it's, you know, it kind of, that waiting list too, it grows and grows, you know, the generations or, you know. But you see that too with homeless people, not homeless, but where families offering, oh, you could stay at the cabin or, you know, whatever, and you could come back here and wash or, you know, do your laundry, whatever. But there's people that stay out in cabins, tent frames,
in Nunavut or in your community, do you think? What kinds of things are missing or could help?
Everything. With food, homelessness. We have a food bank maybe for a couple of months, and then for 6 months, no food bank. That's that too. It's
more consistencies.
They have trouble too with that, like getting food banks, having a food bank, especially with the prices of food there and the cost of shipping.
Music credits to Tanya Tagak, an Inuit contemporary throat singer from Providence Bay.
Down.